is what I was calling gamma. It's a function of the fields. And those fields are what were the expectation values of the quantum fields. And we got this by coupling a current. So we took a current. We wrote a current-dependent classical action, which was the original action. We added to it a piece which coupled a current to the field. And then as a function of that current, we tracked what the expectation value of the field was. And then I gave an algorithm for computing a quantity gamma of phi, which was defined in terms of W of j minus the integral d4x j times phi. And W was the thing that was given in terms of the path integral over this classical action with the current turned on. So this was the integral over phi of e to the I action depending on j. And so you're supposed to think of here, j is something which is given, and you integrate over phi. And then now here, this was also given by the derivative of w with respect to j, given those definitions. So if you thought of phi, curly phi, being a function of j, which you find by calculating this path integral, then the logic of gamma was we invert this function to get j as a function of phi, plug that into here, and then we implicitly get gamma as a function of phi.
That integral is
d4x. This one here, yeah, d4x, yeah. So that so far is just definitions, and then it had the property that once we had done that, the analog of this expression, which tells us phi is a function of j, if you knew what gamma was as a function of phi, you could figure out what j was, the inversion of this formula, by using this equation, which followed from the definition, that if we vary the gamma with respect to phi, then that's equal to minus j. So that's like the quantum corrected classical field equations, if you like, because it's very similar to the equation of motion you would have had using this classical action if you varied that with respect to phi. So when j is equal to zero, which is the theory we're really interested in, then the expectation value of phi when j is equal to zero is the real expectation value of phi in the vacuum, and that's the stationary point of this new thing gamma. Okay. So far so good. So why do you care? So the reason you care is that this gamma is actually the useful thing to think about. So and the way to think of that is to ask, how do these things look if we work in perturbation theory? So how do we compute z of j, w of j, and gamma of phi in perturbation theory, in semi-classical perturbation theory. And this is the approximation that probably the majority of quantum field theory calculations is done within. So the observation, the starting point is just how do you calculate path integrals? What we'll do is we're trying to calculate. We'll start with our starting point is this, which was the path integral to the I action. And the idea is that our way of calculating perturbatively will be to expand. We're doing a saddle point approximation. We're going to take this the action and we're going to expand it around a classical solution of so a stationary point of the action. And so if we do a Taylor series in fluctuations around a classical configuration, We'll start off with something independent of the fluctuations. We'll get something linear, which will vanish, because that's what it means to be a classical solution, is that the first derivative vanishes of the action. Then we'll get a second derivative term, which will have two powers of the fluctuation, and then three powers of the fluctuation, and so on. And the logic will be that we'll take all the things involving three or more powers of the fluctuations, and we'll expand this exponential to give us powers of the fluctuations, weighted by the quadratic piece, the exponential of the quadratic piece. And so that will always give us a Gaussian integral, so powers of fields times an exponential of something quadratic in the fields. And that we know how to do the integral for. So whether this thing I'm telling you is a good approximation or not will depend on the theory, but it's a series you can develop, and it will be a good approximation if you have a small parameter in your theory which counts the loop expansion, it will turn out like what happened in the toy model. So where our program is, we're going to imagine that, supposing phi, we have a solution phi classical. I'll call it phi bar, maybe. For which the derivative classical action vanishes. And what we'll do is we'll take the phis that we're actually interested in this path integral, and we'll write it as being that classical one plus delta phi. I'm going to call it maybe psi. And we'll do the Taylor expand. So we're going to write the action as a function of phi bar plus psi. Schematically, that'll be the action as a function of phi bar. And there'll be a integral d4x of the derivative of the action, phi bar times psi, and so on. And this will vanish because of this condition. So if we continue the series, we'll have, I want to write it now. It's going to get easy to get bogged down in these integrals. So we have S of phi bar, the linear piece which vanished. So then the quadratic piece, I'll write it as 1/2 integral d4x d4y of psi I of x, some operator ij y. And then similarly, there'll be some cubic thing. But let's just call this, the rest of this thing, just psi interaction, depending on phi bar and psi. So this is the stuff that's cubic and more in psi cubed. Then the program is, we take the e to the I s of phi bar plus psi, we write it as e to the I s of phi bar plus this quadratic thing. Let me call this whole quadratic thing S2 of phi bar and psi. And then we Taylor expand everything else. So we have 1 plus I s interaction plus I squared over 2 s interaction squared plus I cubed over 3 factorial s interaction cubed, and so on. And the point of doing this is that for Gaussian integrals, we know how to evaluate a Gaussian integral. Tilt the screen. We still can't see the board. So maybe they're looking from the. I hope you're not looking for the webcam. Let's. They're still having trouble seeing the. Cannot see that right now.
No.
Oh yeah, that's not going to work in the long term.
Yeah. Oh, no, definitely. However, this, like, as soon as you're done the lecture, it will be available on Pearson.
Yeah, but that's a distant second. Okay. I see. So they're actually they're living off of this laptop here. This is a. So this is actually not going to work very well, I don't think. So. This is actually not working very well. Where I can't get the lecture at all if I'm trying to do the camera. Can I get you to set the laptop up so they can see the at least one board, and we can just use the one board?
Hopefully, mesh.
So before,
they have my feed now.
So
this is what they're seeing.
Okay. Yeah. So you'll be tracking me, because the most important thing is that I know what they can see, so that I know to write there, which has kind of been the problem. So you just track what I'm going to do, and I'll use all the boards.
Yeah.
Okay. All right, guys, if you can hear us, you should be now getting the feed where you see the board that I'm writing on. I don't know that you can hear me because you're not moving, but I'm hoping you heard that. So we might have solved the problem by just not being able to see you anymore. And so hopefully you can get signals to us. I'm going to point this a little bit towards the audience because they're likely to see you better than I am. If you see them waving at some point, let me know, please. All right. So the basic thought is to do these integrals is that the way we do a functional integral over a functional Gaussian integral is the same way you would have done an integral for ordinary variables. If you have an integral over n quantities x, and someone gives you xi1 to xin e to the I over 2 mij xi xj from minus infinity to infinity, that integral is zero if there's an odd number of x's. And if there's an even number of x's, what it is it's the product of the inverse of m in all possible ways of making the indices work here. So this will be, it'll be some number, which I'm not going to calculate right now, but it'll be m inverse, you know, say i1, i2, m inverse, i3, i4, m inverse, I n minus 1 I n, which was possible because there's an even number of them, plus permutations. So all possible ways in which you can match these indices I1 to I n into pairs of inverse matrices for m, where m inverse is the inverse of that coefficient thing. That's the poor man's guide to doing Gaussian integrals. And so the same thing will be true for the path integral over psi here. We stick that expansion into here. We're going to have a whole bunch of powers of psi. We have something quadratic in psi with a coefficient delta.
Yeah, what is that delta?
It's just the thing that is multiplying the tube size when you expand the action. So if we had a free theory, this might be, I'll do an example, but this could be something like psi. You know, if we had a free theory, we had something like partial psi plus m squared psi squared, then this, if we integrate by parts, we can write that as being psi times box plus m squared psi or something like that. So some operator is what it'll be. So then when we want the inverse of that operator, for these things, that will be the Green's functions. That'll be things like things that satisfy box plus m squared on it is equal to a delta function. And then we'll stick it in. We have also powers of psi everywhere. And whenever we have an odd power of psi, we just throw it away. If we have an even power, we contract, we match up the Green's functions with the powers of psi in all possible combinations. And Feynman rules are just a way of keeping track of the combinatorics of combining the Green's, the, you know, the inverses of delta in all possible ways to match up with all the powers of phi that were in, or psi that were appearing in those integrands. And so it's just a bookkeeping device to make sure you've got all these permutations, which is easier to do pictorially. In the Feynman rule, what you do is you think every field that's appearing here, if you had four fields here, those would be your four external lines. And then the internal lines are these inverses of M, and you're connecting them in all possible ways. And that's what the Feynman rules do for you. So that's what we're going to do. But we'd like to have an expression for what that means for gamma. I guess there's also one particular, so let's do this expansion in detail for this expression for e to the iw. And it's going to be a little bit different than what I've described here, because here there was no linear term, because we were expanding around a solution to the classical action. We're expanding around a solution that satisfies this. But in this integrand, we actually have this J piece as well. So we're going to have a linear piece, because this thing has not been canceled. This will be have no linear piece when we expand it. But we'll have to track this thing. So one of our Feynman rules will correspond to a line going off and stopping with a J. What a fiasco this is. You back? Okay, good. So wave to us if you have a message you want to send us. But I'm hoping you can see the board now. That's the good thing. All right, so bottom line is we're just doing a bunch of Gaussian integrals, which the Feynman diagrams are kind of capturing the combinatorics of. So let's go through the exercise here. So if we calculate this, this is the integral d phi. And if we do this expansion we've been talking about here, but keep in mind that we have this current term, then we'll have e to the I. S of the background, no linear piece, but we still have the current piece, so we'll have e to the I, ji, psi I. And then we have the quadratic thing, S2 of phi bar and psi. And then we have all the expansion stuff, 1 plus I, S interaction, and so on. So the rule for this would be we're supposed to draw all possible graphs where we had the Feynman rules are, we're actually going to treat this also like an interaction. You're going to see that in the semi-classical approximation, this is something which is of the same size as the things we're perturbing in. So why don't we do that? We'll just I won't actually write that, because I'm going to manipulate this in a second where I want to leave it like this. But we can think of this as being a perturbation too. So we can think of this as being something I could have expanded in. And if I did, then I would have in this expression things like ji, phi I of x, integral d4x. And I might also have things like lambda, integral d4x, phi cubed, if we had one of the interactions had that form, let's say, and other things. Psi, thank you.
Does the functional measure go over the psi?
It doesn't really matter, because the... they're shifting by constant, but yeah, we can do that. So I want to represent a term like this as a line ending at an x, and that x means write a factor of ji of x there. And then something like this would be a vertex with three lines coming together whose coefficient is lambda, with a delta function expressing the fact that everybody's at the same position, say. And so if we were to calculate, if we had started off calculating, this is an aside here. If I had started off calculating a path integral e to the is of phi with powers of phi, a correlation function, the Feynman rule, if I did this expansion process and I expanded this as being the quadratic piece plus interactions, the Feynman rule would have said all of these guys are external lines. So I have if there's n of these guys, I'd have n external lines. So n of these guys. And they'd be labeled by an I and an X and a J and an X, so on. And then in here, I would have all the vertices that came from the interaction. So say I have a cubic vertex, or if I have something else. And then the rule for doing the Gaussian integral, where I take the inverses of the quadratic part and I connect it in all possible ways, corresponds to taking these guys and connecting them with lines in all possible ways, where the lines are the inverses of delta. So a line corresponds to delta inverse ij, where delta is the operator that appeared in the quadratic action, those are our Green's functions. Those are what we would call the propagators normally. And so that would be the algorithm. If we don't have anything like this, then we're doing graphs which have no external lines. So those are vacuum graphs. And so that's what we have here, because everything I'm getting here involves the interactions and this current, but there's nothing else. So there's no external phi lines that would be appearing. So we're going to get a graph here, which will be some mess, lines and vertices everywhere. And every once in a while, there'll be a current that comes out, depending on how many powers of this interaction I had. Those are the kind of graphs that appear. And there might be a graph over here, too. They don't have to be connected graphs. So nothing tells me that there has to be a propagator that gets me from this vertex A to this J. And so the upshot is that this will be the sum of all vacuum graphs, vacuum in the sense that there's no external phi lines. The only external lines are these J's. External J's. I'm going to come back to the J's, because the J's, particularly, I'll go through the toy model where the lambdas are explicit. But what's going to happen is that we're going to develop J also as a series in lambda, and it's going to start at loop order in lambda. So that's why I can think of it as being over here. Well, you could do that, and then that will give you things like if you're trying to calculate W of J, then you're going to keep the J dependence, because you're interested in differentiating with respect to J. And so you know that you differentiate with respect to J and then set J equals 0, that'll give you the correlation functions. And you can kind of see that if I differentiate with respect to J, I pick off the external lines. If I set J equals 0, any lines that I haven't differentiated are going to go to 0. And then I'm going to get a graph which has a bunch of external lines, one for each thing I differentiated. So that's how I see that this Feynman rule is really the same as this Feynman rule. So this is keeping track of the J's, and then differentiating, evaluating J equals 0 will give me this for the correlation function. So I'm just saying the same rule twice, essentially. But the thing is, for these two questions, what's important is that what I really want to get to eventually is what gamma is. And gamma is defined with J equals to some specific function, right? The one that satisfies this. So I'm going to take J is equal to this and put it in there eventually. And that's an implicit thing. And so I'm going to have a series expression for this, which I want to use. And it's going to simplify the graphs in a nice way, you'll see. So it's important that I keep the J's. Well, J is the thing that, in principle, you're turning on to design. If you choose a random field configuration, you're going to choose a J to be the thing that will arrange for your expectation value of your field to equal whatever the field is that you just chose randomly. Because you're thinking of this as being an argument you get to choose for free. And so when you think of this exploring the functional form of this, you're going to go take a bunch of random configurations for phi. And then the J is the current you would have needed to make the vacuum give you that expectation value, whatever it was. Okay, it's all right. So so bottom line, let's so that's what this is. But what about W? W is the logarithm of this. So so let me just tell you the answer here, because this is, because it's not obvious, but you can prove it. Claim is that W, so IW of J, will be the log of the sum of all those graphs. All vacuum graphs with external J's. And the claim is that that's equal to the sum over the connected graphs. So it just means that we don't have to do these disconnected ones anymore. So that's the first thing. So that tells you, in principle, how to calculate W if someone hands you some theory. So now the next thing is, how do we calculate gamma? So what we'll do is we'll take the e to the I gamma. We know that that's equal to e to the I, just by its definition, W of J minus I integral of J times phi. And this is the thing we know is a path integral. So this is e to the minus I integral of phi times j times a path integral with respect to other phi of e to the I action plus I integral of j times phi, where I just wrote that as being this. And then nothing here depends on what you're integrating. So I can put it inside the integral for free. And so I can, instead of writing it this way, is I can put this inside here and have j coupled to phi minus curly phi. So far I haven't done anything except use the definition. But now if we do this, it's useful to, let's expand around curly phi, or let's expand like we were doing before. So let's just do the semi-classical thing. So we'll write phi is equal to phi bar plus psi, and then we'll have e to the I, where delta s delta phi I at phi bar is equal to 0. Then e to the I gamma of curly phi will be the integral d psi of e to the I, and now we expand things out, we'll have e to the I action of a function of phi bar plus I. We have this thing now. So we'll have integral of j times phi bar plus psi minus curly phi. Plus the interaction stuff. Okay. So far, there's nothing exciting here, right? All that's really happened is that we've changed this term here, and it's no longer just j coupled to psi. There's a piece which is phi bar minus phi as well. So these things that don't involve psi and this thing I can just pull out of the integral because they're not they don't depend on the integration variable. So let's do that. I'm flogging this a little bit because when we get to the high energy, low energy thing, it'll be the same and I won't have to do it again. I'll just say this is what the answer is. So if e to the I gamma of phi is e to the I action as a function of phi bar, I integral of j times phi bar minus curly phi. I'm going to make life simple for myself if I just do this in a slightly different order. So I'm not going to really change anything I'm going to say, but let me just write this differently. Instead of doing this experiment, so let's just start here again. So let me just shift phi here by curly phi. So let's write this as integral. So I'll write phi is equal to curly phi plus psi rather than a classical solution. So it'll be curly phi plus psi plus I integral of j times psi. Right? So this is kind of the master formula for how you calculate gamma. And what's implicit about it is that j, you should think of, what's j? J is equal to minus delta gamma delta phi. Once we know what gamma is. So it sounds like it's not a very useful formula because it sounds like it's very implicitly defined. In order to know how the phis appear on this side, I need to know what j is. And to know what j is, I need to know what gamma is. But gamma is what I'm trying to get with this whole thing. So the message of what I'm doing now is that this particular choice for j, as opposed to all the possible j's we could have chosen, which were here, in this story over here, j was arbitrary because we were following it as the variable. In this story, the main difference between that and this is that j is not arbitrary, it's this. And so if j had been arbitrary, the graphs we would be doing would be the same ones, essentially, because we're doing essentially the same path integral. We're just tweaking a little bit what these currents are. But this condition is going to go through and it's going to subtract a whole bunch of graphs. So the bottom line will be that if we write this and we expand around the classical solution and then we evaluate with this choice of j, the algorithm will be we're going to sum a class of graphs which we can define without knowing what gamma is, and so that we'll have a way of calculating gamma just as a sum over graphs and not something implicitly seeming to need to know what gamma is from the beginning.
What is curly phi?
Curly phi is the thing that's the argument of gamma that we're trying to track.
It's not the solution to the equation.
No, because the answer, this path integral is supposed to depend on curly phi. Because that's the thing I'm trying to follow.
So what is
psi? And then psi is defined by this. The only difference is that the only thing I've changed is that I had a step where I wrote phi is equal to classical background plus psi. And I just, instead of doing that, I'm shifting it around curly phi, which is not the classical background. So if I expand this out now, I'm going to get a linear piece from this as well as from this. And then when I do that, you'll see I'm going to get the same answer I just wrote down over there.
Why does the measure?
It didn't change in the sense that if I shift, if I have y is equal to, you know, x plus constant, then dy is equal to dx. And I'm just doing that in field space, that if phi is equal to psi plus a fixed constant that I'm not integrating, then the integral of d phi is equal to d psi.
Would it have been okay to change your measure to curly psi and just treat the other one as fixed?
Well, the thing is that this is something that's not being integrated. This is something which is, you should think for any, so you take a specific phi, like phi is equal to sine x or something, and then, or take this thing and expand it in a Fourier expansion or in a power series expansion, there's a bunch of coefficients there. And then you're thinking of this integral as now a function of those coefficients. And you're integrating something else, but you're not integrating over those coefficients because that's what the answer is, the function of. Okay. So in this story, we have, now let me just. So now, if we just do the same thing, we're going. Now we expand in powers of psi. We'll have the first term will be e to the I classical action as a function of psi. Then we'll have integral d psi of e to the I. There'll be a linear piece, which will be integral dx of delta action delta phi evaluated as a function of curly phi. Plus J times psi. And there'll be this quadratic thing, is2 of curly phi and psi. And that'll be times 1 plus I, the interaction thing expanded around phi. So it only depends on curly phi and psi because I'm expanding the action around curly phi and not around the classical action. And the fact that it wasn't the classical action just means that this is doesn't have J in it now, it also has this. Okay, so the Feynman rule story at this point is, if you walked in here having just seen that story, you would say, oh yeah, I know what this is. This is the sum of all vacuum graphs where I have external lines, external, it's always the board behind the one you want. That's the one you, somewhere I've got a, it's gone. Maybe I erased it. So this is a sum of vacuum graphs so that some complicated thing not necessarily connected with external things on them, and those external things are no longer J, it's now this whole thing. So where that corresponds to a factor of, I'm supposed to write delta S delta phi I plus J. So now to get gamma, I take the logarithm. That does the usual thing. It just means I just now do the connected graphs. So gamma equals log of sum of all graphs. So this is all now all connected graphs, vacuum graphs. And we're, so I take some random graph. The Feynman rule for this thing with an x on it is that that's a factor of, again, delta s delta phi plus j. And the last thing I'm supposed to do is to evaluate it at J is equal to, I want to evaluate at J is equal to minus delta gamma delta phi. So that means that this, J only appears here. So this will become delta delta phi of S minus gamma. Now you see what's going to happen is that if we didn't do the integral at all, what would happen is that we'd have just, this would be saying gamma is equal to the classical action. If we dropped everything here except for the one, we'd have some Gaussian integral, and the Gaussian integral gives us the thing I was never writing here, the prefactor here involves a determinant of m, so there's some determinant of delta we'd have to do. And then these things will start giving us higher and higher loop graphs. But that shows you that to the extent that this process of, that this is bigger than the Gaussian integral is bigger than the powers of S, the S int. This shows you that gamma is the leading approximation, the classical action, plus things that are suppressed by whatever suppresses the loop expansion. So the difference gamma minus S is something which is proportional to the small things that count loops. So in particular, this does. And what is this? So if someone had given me gamma, it's the sum of all vacuum graphs. If I differentiate it with respect to phi, what am I supposed to do? I'm supposed to take all the phis that are in my answer, in my graph, and I vary it. And that corresponds graphically to, if I had a propagator, so let me say it as a claim. Taking delta gamma delta phi corresponds to inserting everywhere an external phi line. So for example, if we had, supposing our interaction, that's simplest to do showing an example. So let's say we're looking at a particular thing, like we have a graph like this, where we have a quartic interaction with a current on either side. Or let's say our interaction was S interaction was minus lambda phi cubed minus g phi to the fourth, or something like that. Integral d4x. So then we would have Feynman rules corresponding to, when we expand things, we would have so S of phi plus psi. I shouldn't write this as a, supposing I had a term in the inter, I'm using bad notation here, because S interaction is supposed to be the cubic things in the expansion around curly phi. So I'm not allowed to write it until I write down, let's just say S had a piece in it, which was the integral minus lambda times phi cubed, let's say, d4x. That's better. So then if I expand that term, we're going to get minus lambda integral d4x of curly phi plus psi cubed. And so that's going to be, you know, curly phi cubed plus 3 curly phi squared psi plus 3 curly phi psi squared plus psi cubed, all times lambda. So in the Feynman rules, you know, this is something that was appearing in the classical action, wherever it was, down here, I guess. That's something appearing in there. This is something which is appearing in here. This is something which is now appearing in delta. And this is something which would be appearing in S interaction. So in particular, you see that delta depends on phi, say. So that means that delta ij is whatever it was for all the other terms in Lagrangian, plus a piece, it'd be stuff, plus 3 curly phi. And so if I take delta delta phi, there'll be a piece which is 3 lambda. And similarly, if I can track derivatives everywhere through the action. So if this had originally, so delta inverse used to correspond to one of the lines in the Feynman rules, right? So if I ask, what's it mean to differentiate a Feynman graph, I'm supposed to think of this as being a function of phi, and I differentiate that line, means I'm differentiating this. But if I differentiate that, you know, d d phi of delta inverse is going to be, it'll be minus delta inverse d phi delta inverse. So I can think of this graphically as being a propagator times something times a propagator, and that something is the thing I get by differentiating delta, so it's something involving lambda. So that graphically would be like something like this, where I now have a line coming off, because this lambda was the thing that went with a cubic interaction. So it's like having, I took a line, by differentiating with phi, I've essentially grown, I've stuck an external line where I onto the line I was differentiating. And similarly, if we had had a phi to the, if I'd written a term here which was phi to the fourth, d4x, this would give me a term which was like phi times psi cubed in the expansion. So S interaction would now have a background phi in it. If I differentiated that, if I originally had a cubic interaction in my Feynman graph, where this coefficient was, say, g times phi, if this had a coefficient g. If I differentiate with respect to phi, I'm going to now differentiate that. And so that's going to be like growing another line there and making an external line. So if I take a Feynman graph and I differentiate with respect to phi, I'm essentially sticking external lines everywhere, where an external line on an existing internal line corresponds to the insertion of a cubic interaction, because it's really coming from a cubic interaction in the Lagrangian. And a new external line, a line being drawn on a vertex, means if I had, what looked like a cubic interaction, but it really came from a quartic interaction because I've expanded around some background, I'm now seeing the fact that it was a quartic interaction. So the upshot is that if I want to write this out, I can write this out as, these were some of vacuum graphs, but what I can do is now it's vacuum, this thing is a sum of vacuum graphs with an external line stuck in everywhere. So if I had, if vacuum graphs were some graph which had nothing on the outside, I now have some graph where I've got one external line on the outside, is what this is going to look like. So the point of the exercise now, so here, so let me just say the point because I'm probably flogging it to death. Let's use something that I haven't used yet. So the point of the exercise is that we had gamma was sum of all vacuum connected vacuum graphs. So let's say here's one. Big thing going on and there's some external currents out everywhere. So then d gamma d phi. So here I need to be, there's a, one more thing I should have been more careful about. Where did I write that gamma was equal to something? So I lied to you in one sense here. The thing that's the sum of the graphs is the path integral. But you remember the expression I just erased here was that the gamma was the classical action times the path integral. So what I should have written here was that gamma minus s is the log of the sum of everything, right? Because I had e to the I gamma was e to the I s integral d psi of stuff. This was the sum of the graphs, and this is just going along for the ride. So I should have really put it on the other side. So this difference is the sum of these graphs. I'm differentiating that difference, so I'm just taking the sum of all graphs with now an external line on it. So this will be equal to gamma minus s is that. So d is equal to the sum of all connected. Now that vacuum graphs meant there's no external phi lines, there's only external current lines. So now I'm going to have one external phi line, which those are called tadpole graphs. So this is something, God knows what's in here, there's some currents. But then now there's just one thing which is not a current, which is the thing I got by differentiating with respect to phi. And the rule is that I'm supposed to take j is equal to minus this. So what's going to happen, because it's s minus gamma, not gamma minus s. So what I'm supposed to do is everywhere I've got one of these things, I'm supposed to stick in minus the sum of all tadpole graphs. So if you gave me a graph like that, what that's become, when I evaluated with this choice for the current, that will become a graph like this. Because here I'm supposed to sum over all possible things that have one line coming off of it, and that's the thing I attach onto this. Because the current, the x here, was equal to this, the sum of all possible graphs with one external line. So order by order in the expansion, the loop expansion, what will happen is that I'm going to get all possible tadpole graphs here. And so what's going to happen is that if everywhere in this expansion for gamma, I'm going to get graphs, there will be graphs of the form like this that have no currents on them. Then there'll be graphs like this which have one current on them. And what will happen is that when I evaluate the current at the specific current I'm supposed to evaluate at to get me gamma, this graph is going to systematically cancel that graph. So the rule will be that I'm supposed to sum over all graphs except for those that can be cut into two by dividing by breaking one line. Because all of those are the ones that are being canceled by this requirement that I'm subtracting these external j's are being chosen to be at this particular j, which is being chosen in such a way that it's the derivative of the gamma minus s, which is the sum of all the tadpole graphs. And if I broke this thing in half, what would be left would be a tadpole graph. And so the bottom line is that it looks complicated, but the answer is simple. So the bottom line gamma is the sum all now vacuum. So connected. Vacuum means that there's no external anythings now. And it's one PI graphs. So that means it's graphs with no external legs. That's what the vacuum means. And one PI stands for one particle irreducible. And that means that, well, the thing I just said, that a one particle reducible graph is one where I can cut it into disconnected graphs by breaking one line. So one particle reducible is something like this that can be divided into two by breaking just one line. So this is the sum of all graphs that are not like that. It's irreducible. And so because of that, this quantum action is sometimes also called the 1PI generator. It's the thing that generates all one particle irreducible correlation functions. So the idea is if you differentiate this n times with respect to phi, evaluate it at the phi, which is the phi you get when the current is zero, that will give you correlation functions that are the sum of all one particle irreducible graphs with as many external lines as you differentiated in the theory that you're interested in. And the reason that these are important things is that, so what do you do if someone hands you a one particle irreducible graph? Or they hand you this, how do you get the whole answer, the complete answer? The answer for that is you treat it as if it was the classical action. So if you want to know what the expectation value for phi is, you extremize this. That's the thing we saw, that the d gamma d phi equals zero will give you the expectation value of phi. But if you want to know, so the correlation function for like 15 fields, then what you should do is you should take all the, expand gamma around the real vacuum, and that will give you a bunch of propagators and vertices in the same way as you would have had if you thought of this as the classical action. And if you build all of the tree graphs from this, you will get the answer you would have gotten by doing all of the graphs starting from the classical action. So it's the thing that if you stick it into a tree graph will give you the whole answer, including the quantum corrections. And it's because of that that all of the ultraviolet people kind of talk about one particle irreducible actions when they're talking about renormalizing theories, because if you're trying to follow divergences, divergences all come from loops. If someone can give you, if you just do tree graphs, you're never doing loops. And so all of the divergences in a quantum field theory are in gamma. And they're not in W, and they're in W and J, but they're in a way which is confusing because you have things that are not easy to interpret physically. So this is something which comes up a lot. It's simple to calculate. And we want to know, if someone tells you what this is, they've told you an awful lot of everything you need to know about the theory. They've told you how to renormalize it. They've told you how to calculate scattering amplitudes. They've told you how to calculate correlation functions. They've told you everything. And so we're going to be interested in defining something like this but only for the low energy part of a theory if there's now a heavy and a light particle. So that was kind of probably a mixture of too much detail and too little detail, depending on what you knew already. So the main thing is that you should be happy that there is an algorithm. Someone hands you an action. You can calculate the correlation function for the generating function for correlation functions by exponentiating this and integrating over phi, which in practice means summing graphs the way you normally would sum graphs. And there's a quantity that you can compute, which is related to the Legendre transform of the logarithm of that thing, which is a particularly efficient way of encoding all the information inside the sum of all possible graphs, and so all correlation functions in your theory. And this is the guy we're going to be aiming for. This is the quantum version of the action at some level. It's the thing that if somebody had handed you an action classically, and you want to say, well, how does the quantum field behave differently than the classical field? One way of addressing that question would have been to calculate this thing, seeing how it differs from the classical action. And so the things that are the extremize this needn't be the same as the things that extremize the classical action, and that's the way in which quantum effects are changing the values of fields. And that's also, you've seen, given by the sum of all the tadpole graphs, because the difference between the action gamma and the classical action S differentiated is the sum of all tadpole graphs. Yes. Good question.
It has more symmetries.
So the question is, does gamma have the symmetries that S has?
So I think yes, but.
It depends on the symmetry. So if the symmetry is linear, so if the field is transforming linearly, then you can prove from the definitions that if S has a symmetry, then so does gamma.
But what about the symmetries of the gamma?
With one, there's one caveat though, because so what you can show is that the integrand has the symmetries, and the issue is the measure that those symmetries. So if it's true that the measure can also be defined in an invariant way, then it will be true that any symmetries of the classical action will become, any linear symmetries of the classical action will become linear symmetries of this. And the issue of anomalies is all about, there's some symmetries for which there does not exist an invariant measure. So then that would be a case where this will not be invariant even though the classical action was. But it could also be true that you have nonlinear symmetries. And then there's the statement's more complicated because because what you do is you do the change of variables, which is the symmetry transformation, and then you show that you didn't change anything. And in the nonlinear case, it's also true. But it's normally, at least in the cases of interest, normally, because the normal statement about nonlinear transformations, when you're doing a nonlinearly realized symmetry, what you normally do is you use the transformation rule that is very general in the sense that you can always do a field redefinition that makes the transformation take the standard form that you use. And so since it's always phrased that way, what generally would happen is if you had some nonlinear transformation, you may not be in the quantum theory, you may not be in the set of you may have to do a change of variables to ensure that the fields transform in the way that you thought they did. So the transformation rules for the symmetry transformation might get renormalized. So for example, supposing the symmetry was phi goes to, I'm gonna make up something stupid, like phi goes to phi plus phi squared or something. You know, it might be that the quantum system might have a symmetry which is phi goes to phi plus 3 phi squared or something. So where the coefficient of phi squared changed because there was a quantum renormalization that happened there. So all the parameters in your transformation might get renormalized is the thing you have to worry about. That's because of the nonlinearity of the transformation. So it's always true that if you have even if you had a free theory, you have to renormalize products of fields because there's very singular things. Products of fields, particularly when they're evaluated at the same point, there are very singular objects, and so they often have to be renormalized, and that is something you have to worry about if you have a nonlinear transformation. But for linear transformations, it doesn't come up. It's just then the only issue is the measure.
Here we
are at H bar,
right?
Oh, H bar is one, but in principle, if I had tracked H bar, it would be the thing counting loops.
Yeah. So you're saying that you can pull out the thing that you're using in counting loops, like lambda.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
So, but shouldn't what I've seen before is when you expand this thing, like the fluctuations are basically have h bar.
That's true.
So here.
I have a hard time tracking factors of one. That's. but go ahead. I mean, it's not.
Or lambda.
Or lambda. Well, the thing is, so the thing is, you're thinking that psi has got an h bar in it.
Psi has to be small, I think, compared to the rest of the stuff, right?
So. Psi, you're integrating over psi. Psi goes from minus infinity to infinity. So there's no sense in which it's small. The issue is whether or not you're doing a saddle point approximation. So the assumption was that the action, that in the e to the I action, you had something which came out front and sat in the bottom there so that you had a huge action. When you expanded around the classical, because you had a huge action, when you expand around the classical minimum, you can use the saddle point approximation, and you're going to be guaranteed that the expansion around the saddle point will be suppressed by powers of this small thing. And so the way I prefer to think of that is that it's not that psi was small. Psi was integrated from minus infinity to infinity, but the thing that you're expanding it around is large. And if I wanted to track all the so if I track the but it's probably going to go to the same place that you wanted to go to anyway. I never let you finish your sentence. So you wanted psi to be small. Why did you want psi to be small?
I wanted to see what is the expansion. Like,
primarily is here.
So,
I thought that it was inside.
Well, if you know, you can move it around because the thing with size, because you're integrating, you can always do changes of variables on it. So people can change the emphasis of the argument by scaling lambdas into psi. But I'd rather not do that. So if you just said that the action has a, like in the toy model, there was just a 1/lambda in front of the whole action if I use the right variables. So let's say that that's true. And then in all this expansion, there's no lambdas anywhere except for just as an overall 1/lambda in front of the whole action. So that means that I'm going to have a 1/lambda here. And a 1/lambda here, so that means delta goes like 1/lambda. So delta. I'm going to be doing an integral where phi is just given to me as a number, and I'm going to do the integral over psi, and I'm doing a series when I expand the action and powers of S interaction. Where I'm assuming that it's going to be things successive terms are suppressed by a small thing, and then I'm going to say that that's going to give me gamma as a series, and I'm going to make the argument now that if it's true that your action has the feature that you can think of as the order one things with a 1/lambda in front of the classical action, the claim I'm going to make is that if I track through this series I was giving you, the lambdas will appear systematically in such a way that every loop will give you a factor of lambda. And the first term will be going like 1/lambda, because the first term is that S gamma is S, which goes like 1/lambda. The one loop thing, the determinant thing, will be independent of lambda. And then the first thing that involves S interaction is going to be proportional to lambda squared and so on. So that lambda specifically, if lambda 1/lambda comes out of the whole action, then lambda counts every loop. But each loop, every specific loop is all the same size. So all the various one loop graphs have the same factor of lambda in front of them. And so that's probably an exercise that's best done at home, but the way it goes is, you know, this is the 1/lambda. Delta goes like 1/lambda because it's just the second derivative of the action, but then delta inverse then goes like lambda. So every internal line now has a lambda. Every vertex has a 1/lambda. And if I go through and I look at all the graphs, there'll be, you know, if I take a particular graph like this one, say, there's two vertices, so there's two 1/lambdas, but there's three lines. So there's a lambda squared. That gave me a 1/lambda. So compared to the classical action, that's down by two lambdas. And so this is a one loop answer. This is a two loop answer, which is two loops. But if you kind of track that through, you can show that for any number of loops, the vertices and the lines are always, the topology of the graph forces them to come together in such a way that lambda is counting the loops. And there'll be a tricky thing if you have a graph like this where you can't draw it in a plane. So then you have to decide what you mean by a loop. But what you'll do is you'll define a loop to be the thing that is a loop on the plane, and it's the thing that counts lambdas. So where it was ambiguous, you define it, the loop, to be the thing that is where the lambdas, that's counting lambdas. So the bottom line is that there's a perturbation theory here that you can use, and it's in the case that the action goes like 1/small thing, that's the loop expansion. The lambda counts the loop expansion. So now let me just telegraphically say how this changes if you have a heavy and light system. So now we'll imagine that we have think of the toy model. So let's say you have a heavy field. Let's take the toy model. So we have phi I and we had phi r, and our Lagrangian was minus d mu minus 1/2 and then we had a potential, and we knew that if we looked at the quadratic part of this action, we knew that the minimum of the potential was at phi r was equal to v, and its friends that are related to it by under symmetry transformation. And then when we expanded, we got masses, and where these things assume the particular v lambda over 2, 4, phi star phi minus v squared. So what we like to do, so the logic of effective field theory is, in principle, if you wanted to set the thing up in terms of, you know, the one thing that you know for sure is that If I always start at energies that are lower than this mass, and I never start with any heavy particles, then it will always be true that no matter what happens, at the end of the day, I'll be left with only, if I imagine doing some scattering process, if I start with only light particles whose energy is less than this mass, I'm always going to end with only light particles whose energy is less than this mass, because energy conservation forbids me producing any heavy particles. So I'm guaranteed that if initially energy, the total energy of my system is less than m, so that means in particular that I only have particles, so only phi I particles. Then at late times, the same is also true. Because of energy conservation. So this is really a stupid statement. Conservation. So that's such an obvious statement that you might not think it was worth making. But the point of making that statement is that that means that there will be some time evolution for this light system, which I can express completely in terms of the light fields. The point in a field theory, any operator that acts on the light particles can be constructed using the light particle creation and annihilation operators, or their Fourier transforms, which are the base of the fields. So there must exist an evolution operator in the Hilbert space that's built completely from the light fields that describes the exact evolution of the system in this regime. And in particular, the important thing is that it does not have to depend on any of these phi r's. As long as I never have a process which has a phi r in it as a final state or initial state. I meant that the vacuum, the classical solution for that minimized the potential was phi star phi equals v squared, and I chose the in the example we were looking at, we had this Mexican hat potential where there's a whole circle's worth of solutions, and I was choosing to expand around the one where phi I was zero and phi r was equal to v. That's the yeah. All right, so therefore, the final state will be some unitary, say, t equals infinity, t equals minus, I don't know what you want to call this, so it's some unitary operator acting on the initial state, where u star u is equal to 1, or I can write u is equal to e to the minus I ht, where h is remission. And the content of this statement up here is h is some function of phi I only. It might be a complicated function, but there will be some function of phi I only, which I can, might be a non-local function, might be some really ugly thing, but it's something, there must exist some operator involving phi I, which will evolve my initial state to my final states, because this is something which involves only phi I particles and no phi r particles, and it does that because I've chosen the initial energies to be light enough, low enough, that I can't produce a phi r particle if I didn't start with one, and I don't start with one because I don't have enough energy to have one. So we want to seek this thing. If we can find that thing, that will be the thing that will be describing, we can think of the Lagrangian that gave us that h, and that will be the thing that will is what we're going to call our effective Lagrangian. And so so the claim, the point of the next lines of argument is going to be that in general this is a mess, but if you this thing will, whatever it is, it'll depend on the properties of the heavy field. So this will be some function of phi, but it parametrically can depend on things like MR and lambda and things that were in the original Lagrangian. And if we do a Taylor expansion in powers of 1 over MR, the statement will be that this, although in general this is some ugly mess, thought of as a series in 1 over MR, it's a simple mess. It's something which is a local set of things like we were talking about when we talked about the toy model. It's some integral over space of some local polynomial fields and their derivatives at some specific spot in space. But that requires us to work in powers of 1 over MR to make that conclusion. So we want to know how to construct this thing. And one way to do it is to try and get at it through the, we're more interested in talking about actions than Hamiltonians, because that's the more convenient way in the path integral. So we'd like to have some sort of a path integral way of getting at constructing this H effective. And so what we're going to do is try and set up, we'd like to set up this formalism before we actually try and get the action. What we'll do is we'll try and get at it by setting up an expression for the generator of correlation functions of these light fields. So what we'll do is imagine trying to construct, so defined the effective action that gives us this Hamiltonian. What we'll do is we'll construct the generating functional, the 1pi, or the gamma that generates correlations, but only of the light fields. Only. So that, I almost called it a 1pi action, but it's not really 1pi action. It's going to be what I'm going to call a 1 light pi action. So it's a 1 light particle irreducible action. So it's the 1 lpi action, in a way that you'll see exactly what that means in a second. So 1 light particle irreducible. So we're going to get something which is going to be the sum of, it's irreducible in the sense that you can't cut it in two by breaking one line if that line is a light particle. If it's a heavy particle, you have to keep it even if it's irreducible. So I want to construct something whose derivatives give me all the light particle correlations in the full theory, but I don't care about any heavy particles. So I'm not going to try and couple a current to the heavy field to see what its correlation functions are, because I don't really care what they are. I'm just interested in low energies. And so that will allow me to simplify the construction we just did a little bit, because we're going to focus only on the light particles. And the way we'll do that is we'll couple a current only to the light particles. And so what we have to do is just trace through the logic that I just went through, with the only difference being that instead of having a current coupled to everybody, we're now going to have a current coupled only to the light particles. And so I'll do it properly maybe next time, but you can kind of see what's going to happen already. So the whole story here was, yada, 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 expansion, 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 sums of graphs, sums of graphs, sums of graphs. You end up doing one particle irreducible graphs to get gamma. And it was irreducible because you had a current in the problem. And the current was always adjusting itself to cancel off the reducible graphs. So now if I have two kinds of fields, heavy fields and light fields, but I only have currents for the light fields because it's only the light fields I want to be able to differentiate with respect to the current to get correlations functions of, I will not couple currents to the heavy fields. So if the light fields, the same story goes through, that I'll have a current that's adjusting for every light field to cancel all the one particle reducible graphs. But for the heavy fields, the current is zero. So there's no adjustment going on. So you just get all the graphs that you would have had when you were calculating here, but you're now evaluating at j equals zero. And so because it's at j equals zero, you don't get the cancellation that canceled all the reducible graphs anymore. So if we calculate the bottom line that I'm going to show next time is that if we calculate the thing in the full theory that generates the correlation functions only of the light particles, then it has a similar expression to what we've been doing before. But the rule is we're supposed to sum over all vacuum graphs that are connected, and they're one light particle irreducible. So they can't be broken into. They can be broken into if the line we break is a heavy line, but they cannot be broken into if the line you break is a light line, is the only change, and that's the. That's the bottom line for what gamma will be. And so the way we'll get the Hamiltonian or the action from that is that we're not only going to be able to, so that will be something in principle, if you knew what it was, that would tell you everything there is to know about the light particle theory, the light part of the light part of the theory. So we like to write that thing as a path integral that looks similar to the ones we've been doing. So we'd like to write something like e to the I gamma as a function of the light field is integral d psi of e to the I some function, I don't know what it is, of the light field. Let's say light field plus psi plus I current times psi. And this thing, whatever it is, that's what we're going to define to be the action. This is the thing, if we can find a formula for this that looks like this, we're going to call this the action. Because if someone walked into the door right now when I wrote this line down and said, oh yeah, this was the classical action, this is your one particle irreducible generator, so this must have been the classical action. But this is going to come to us as a something which we're going to construct from the full theory, because we originally started off with an integral over light and heavy fields. We did the integral over the heavy field, and we can do the integral over the heavy field because it doesn't appear with the current, so it's just appearing in the action part. And then the comparison of what the full calculations that we would want to do to this will tell us how to read this off, this effective action.
So you're integrating over the effective.
So if you like, the schematically, originally, this would have been integral d heavy field, d light field, e to the I, full action is a function of heavy field and light field, plus a current only coupled to the light field. So if you like, if I compare that to that, what I'm going to do is I'm going to say that e to the I effective action is a function of the light field is the integral of the heavy field of e to the I full action, more or less. And so, and I don't need to keep the currents because the current's not talking to the heavy field. But there's some subtleties in this. So for example, in our toy model, what's heavy, what's light? Strictly speaking, it's energy that counts. So I should be throwing, the heavy field should be all of the modes of the heavy field, the one that actually has all our energy states are bigger than the mass. But for the light field, I have also very large momentum states. So they should also be in the heavy. So H here should be the very short wavelength parts of the light field and the heavy fields, all modes of the heavy field. And the light fields would just be the long wavelength modes of the light fields. And so the way in practice you would define these currents is you define these currents to vary slowly in space and time, and that will pick off the fields that are varying slowly in space and time, because a quickly varying field will give you zero in this integral here. And so, but morally, that's what's going to happen. So we're going to do the integral of the full action over the heavy things, where heavy means everybody, light and heavy, which is short wavelength, call that the effective action, and then that will appear in everything in the way that a classical action would have appeared. And the miracle is that once you've done this, you get something which looks at all sensible. It's the integral of some local thing. But that will only happen once we Taylor expand this in the inverse powers of the heavy mass. But in a nutshell, that's the rest of the formalism. This is the connected vacuum 1PI, one LPI graphs. Well, it would have been connected except for the J thing. So if the J were zero, then it would just be the connected graphs. But because J is adjusting to be minus d gamma d phi, that part picks off the one light particle irreducible graphs in the same way that it did in the full thing. So what you're saying is true if I had e to the I w of J. For fixed J, it would be the sum of all the connected graphs. But once I evaluate J at the specific, I do the Legendre transform and evaluate J at the specific thing. Except that the difference is that I'm thinking of J as being a function of L, because this depends only on L. And it's the function, so the thing I didn't write was the thing I wrote before. Evaluated at J equals minus d gamma dl.
That's another way of composing the.
Yep. But that's also the same thing as saying that you keep the one particle irreducible graphs. But we're only doing that now for the light fields, not the heavy fields, because there's no current. So for the heavy fields, it's what you said. It's just all the connected heavy field graphs. OK, so we'll pick it up there next week.